Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, online fitness coach, nutritionist, and three-time best-selling author, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest for episode 400 is Hollywood actor Ethan Suplee. A lot of you will be familiar with Ethan, either from his voice, from the American Glutton podcast, which I was on recently as well, one of my favorite podcasts I'm subscribed to, but also from his movie and TV roles. Ethan's actually been in some of my favorite personal movies. I tell a little bit of a story at the start of the podcast. He's been in Mallrats, My Name is Earl, American History X, Blow, Cold Mountain, The Wolf of Wall Street, Deep Water Horizon, Remember the Titans, and a personal favorite, Boy Meets World, a Disney show from back in the day, for those of you who are old enough to remember that. And he's one of my favorites when it comes to his podcast alongside his own professional work. So it was an honor today, but it's not that we speak about in today's podcast. What you also might have seen, and you'll definitely see if you follow my social media, is his incredible transformation from 550 pounds to 255 pounds, losing nearly 300 pounds. And in today's podcast, we focus on that story. So being forced to diet as a kid and how it affected his food relationship, getting over the guilt and shame cycle that came with failing diets, removing your failures from the diet and not self-identifying with it, and how some of his movie and TV roles helped to temporarily alleviate some of those self-imposed weight loss pressures that he had in himself, and the role that physical activity played in his body transformation, amongst other things. This was 400 episodes in, up there with one of my favorite ever conversations that I got to have, partly because I'm such a big fan of his work on screen and off when it comes to the podcast, but also he's just such a genuinely nice guy. And when I got to connect with him on his podcast, as soon as we were finished, we're like, please come online. Let's talk about your story. I think we'll get an amazing conversation. So hopefully you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed recording it. If you did, be sure to take a screenshot, pop it up on your Instagram stories. You can tag both of us. Brian_Keane_fitness is my Instagram handle. And Ethan Suplee, S-U-P-L-E-E, all one word on Instagram. So definitely tag it up on there. And hopefully we'll get to connect for another episode in the future. So without further ado, here is Hollywood actor Ethan Suplee on losing over 290 pounds, weight loss mistakes to avoid, and the major lessons he learned along the way. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined with my guest, Ethan Suplee. Ethan is a Hollywood actor and the host of American Glutton podcast. Ethan has established himself over the past few decades as an actor of considerable talent and accomplishment. His diverse and eclectic resume ranges from hilarious roles in such comedies as Mallrats and My Name is Earl to hauntingly dramatic performances in intense features such as American History X, Blow, Cold Mountain, The Wolf of Wall Street, and Deep Water Horizon. His breakthrough performance as a young footballer player in Disney's Remember the Titans in 2000 with Denzel Washington garnered him critical acclaim. He also has one of the most incredible physical transformations I've ever seen, going from 550 pounds to 255 pounds, all of which we'll be unpacking in today's podcast. I'm looking forward to talking all things weight loss, diets, and his fantastic story in today's episode. Ethan, welcome to the podcast.
Brian, thanks so much for having me.
Ethan, I didn't want to say this on your podcast just because I was kind of fangirling because I'm such a big fan of the show anyway when I was on yours. But funny story, we have four or five DVDs in our house. One is the Game of Thrones season one and the others are Mallrats, Remember the Titans, and American History X.
Oh my God, that's awesome. Yeah, that's so cool.
I didn't want to say it on your podcast because we were talking a lot of different things, but my audience know me, and just to kind of give props for your actual work outside of all the weight loss stuff that we're unpacking today. I just wanted to add that. But Ethan, we're not going to get into that today. I want to talk on your tremendous weight loss story. I've been a fan of the podcast for ages, so I know and I'm very clued in with what you did. But for anyone that's unfamiliar with your story, talk to us a little bit about the weight loss journey. And you can start wherever you want with this, because you started back at, you know, at your heaviest at 550 pounds, I think was your heaviest. Talk to us about your story and we can kind of go into a couple of different directions from there.
Sure. I was put on my first diet when I was 5 years old. And, you know, I'm not super familiar with what's happening in Great Britain and Ireland with as far as obesity goes. But in America, I think if we looked at obese children today, we would see a different landscape than 40 years ago or 40 plus years ago when I was five, and what a fat kid looked like, basically. I think by today's standards, I had some baby fat, right? But this was kind of something my parents didn't know how to deal with. And my grandparents were like, we need to get this sorted out immediately. We're putting him on a diet. And I got put on this diet, which was basically, you know, when I would reach for a second serving of food at dinner, I'd get my hand slapped and told that's not for me. It didn't have, put it easily, the desired effect that they had wanted. And I have some empathy for them. I'm a father. And so I know there are many instances where I have to determine what is right for my children. You know, my kids are mostly grown now, but when they were small kids, it's my job to determine what is right for them. And like, if they're doing something that I feel is unhealthy, I have to stop them. But the consequence of this was that I just got very good at sneaking food and binge eating, kind of out of sight of authority. And that became kind of the way I habitually ate. Eating for me became a really bad thing that I had to do in private because, you know, I didn't want people to see me commit this shameful act. So, you know, by the time I was kind of autonomous and earning money, I would just, you know, eat by myself at the end of a night. And usually it would be a big binge eat. My mother was obsessively health conscious. So all of our, you know, I think this predates the advent of GMOs, really. That wasn't a big thing back then. But like when organics kind of came into existence, everything was organic and nothing was artificial. And I still, eating that stuff, managed to gain weight. I was put on every conceivable diet as a child. Some of them were, you know, the Beverly Hills diet, which is insane. Fit for Life, which is insane. The only gal that I kind of remember fondly today who was writing diet books that I was kind of, these were read to me as a kid, was this girl, Adele Davis. And they were very much like sensible approaches to eating in a healthy way for your body. And even today, a lot of them are just her relating experiences. So I'm not like mad at her, but like I think the Beverly Hills diet's pretty awful, especially for a young child.
How old were you eating around this time when you were experimenting with diets in terms of finding what would work?
I really think of it more as diets being experimented on me rather than with me, because I wasn't such a willing participant. But I was probably 8 or 9 when I was put on the Beverly Hills diet. You know, at 10, I was on Atkins, which was, you know, that generation's version of keto. Back then, I think the word keto was specifically for epileptics. Now keto's, you know, the be-all, end-all to some people. So I kind of had that experience. And then largely as a young adult, but like when I was being responsible for myself, you know, as a teenager, I started working and, you know, nobody's going to now tell me what to eat from a point of authority. And it wasn't until my early 20s, I got sober and I kind of woke up one day and was like, oh, now that I'm dealing with sobriety, I want to also deal with this with my body and my relationship with food. So I kind of came into being a participant in these diets with all this knowledge and not necessarily knowledge, but data from previous diets, from Candida and, you know, I'd done the cabbage soup diet and the Hollywood diet and the South Beach. That might have been a little bit later, but I had all these ideas of blood type and what created fungus in the blood. And so every diet I kind of did as an adult where I looked at it and went, I want to do this diet. There were kind of like a couple aspects that went into it. There was a bit of faith, right? Like I would get sold the elevator pitch on a diet and believe it because you know, in that state, you're so desperate for hope. You're so desperate for an answer. And I had very low self-esteem. I found myself wanting to hide within my own skin a lot of the times. And so all a diet meant to me ultimately was that I got to become a normal person. And with that, I thought that all of my problems, all of my mental anxieties and anguishes would resolve if I just lost weight. And so it was more, these diets offered more than just this health marker or metric or even a vanity metric. It was like my entire life was going to improve and be this fairy tale life if I could lose weight. So I wanted to believe. I wanted that hope. And I bought hook, line, and sinker every fad diet that came around. You know, I was raised in Los Angeles, and most of my life I spent in Los Angeles, which is a real big epicenter for these kind of wacky diets. And so I did all of them. You know, there was a period of my life as a child that I was not allowed to eat anything white. And by anything white, I mean like turkey was off limits and white cabbage was off limits and white onions were off limits. And then like a year later, we found out that was all wrong. It's anything red is bad. So red peppers and red cabbage and red onions and red meat are bad and you can't eat any of that. And red kidney beans are bad, but garbanzo beans are fine. And just like nonsense. So that was my life. And that is largely how I spent from, you know, 23 until I was around 40 when, you know, I had done keto for years and I really believed that I was allergic to carbohydrates. But not only that, I believed everybody was allergic to carbohydrates. I believed in this thing called grain brain, that everybody was walking around in this fog of carbohydrates. And I would lose weight on keto and then I would get to a point where I wasn't losing weight anymore. And so I would get really clean and be, you know, because there's all kinds of weird stuff you can do on keto where, like, if you're eating bacon and salami and cheese all day long, yeah, it could be keto. You could be in ketosis. But like, I would then go like, okay, I need to be eating chicken thighs and olive oil. And I would get really strict like that. And then I'd lose a little bit of weight and then I would not lose weight. And I'd be very strict and I'd go like, okay, I'm eating too many chicken thighs. So I found myself just on a calorically restrictive version of keto. And I threw my hands up and I was like, what am I doing? This doesn't make any sense. And it was kind of at that point that I went like, I'm going to throw away everything I believe I know from my lifetime of dieting. And I'm just going to look at data and based on that data, I'm going to figure out something that works. And, you know, more so than what I eat, and that is very important. I find that if I'm eating, you know, single ingredient foods, whole foods, I feel better than if I'm eating processed foods. So I do find that to be important, but that doesn't mean that processed foods are absolutely excised from my diets. There's still a time and place for them. But so that is important. But even more than that, I found that it was my behavior with food that was really the underlying issue that had to have and undergo the biggest change.
Before we unpack behavior, and I definitely want to circle back to shame and guilt around food, because sure, I think that's something that a lot of people struggle with. But what, Ethan, would you say is one of the fundamentals that you know now that you wish you had known back then? Because I'd imagine you had to probably forget a lot of things and re-educate yourself because of the miseducation. But what's a fundamental that you have now through years of doing it yourself, years of talking to experts and, you know, going down the rabbit hole when it comes to diets? What's a fundamental that you know now that you wish you had known back then?
The thing that I've gotten most diligent about that I think applies to every diet that is successful with fat loss is energy balance. And so it doesn't, I mean, it can on an individual level for sure matter what you eat in as far as adherence to a diet goes. But if you're eating more than the amount of energy you're using in a day, you are not going to lose fat. And that is kind of the thing that I went like, oh, so I could do a pizza diet and let's see how I feel. If I just do this calculation and I understand how much my body uses in energy every day and I don't exceed that, am I going to lose fat on a pizza diet? And the answer is yes. Now, I wouldn't feel great. It's not optimal for like spending time in the gym and, you know, not having a stomach ache most of the time. But if my goal is only fat loss, I could achieve it doing that. And that was kind of when I threw my hands up at all of the, you know, lectins, and vegetables are poison, and certain types of nightshades, and, you know, sugar is evil, and, you know, all of it for me. And granted, I don't eat a lot of sugar, but that's simply because, you know, if I'm in the gym working out and I get a feeling of low blood sugar, which is very rare, but it's happened, I will go have a sugary drink and I'll feel better. And then I'm in the gym working out and I don't feel bad afterwards. If I have that same sugary drink at the end of my night and go to sleep, I wake up feeling almost hungover. So that's kind of the difference, is how am I using the fuel I'm putting in my body, and how much fuel am I putting in my body? You know, I think of my body, I like the analogy of a car, because if at the end of every night our car was transforming the gas you left in its tank into weight, and all the excess weight was slowing the car down, we would get so good at calculating how much gas we needed every day. You know, we'd have apps that would tell us where the gas was, how to get it, so that you cruised in to your driveway at the end of the night just on fumes, right? And had just enough to get back to the gas station the next day. But our car, it just sits in the tank for our car and it's used as needed. Well, our body does that too in a version. It's stored as fat.
I love that. That's a great analogy for people in terms of a visual. And I want to pull back out into the behavior and shame and guilt. And I know it's a Pandora's box of a question, but I'm so curious because of your up and down. I know when we were speaking on your podcast, and I've been listening to American Glutton for ages, so I know a lot of your backstory and how you would rebound up and you'd lose the weight and it'd go back up and a whole host of issues that came with that. But with the shame and guilt in particular, did you find that that was something that you needed to address, or for the lack of a better term, heal first before you were able to have that better behavior with food? Or was it something that happened as a result of just losing the weight and building that self-confidence? What was your process like for shame and guilt in particular when it came to food behavior?
Yeah, I feel like shame and guilt and most of the things that I expected to evaporate when I lost weight are kind of a work in progress, and most likely will be a work in progress forever. So I do believe that you can kind of ruin a person into a state of apathy. And I've experienced that too. And maybe we call it depression. I don't know what, but there have been points where I've felt so much overwhelming shame that I wouldn't get out of bed, right? And so I think that in order to achieve anything, you have to have a bit of confidence, right? Because who goes about trying to do something that they are absolutely sure is impossible? It's kind of a rare thing. And so that's where I think a lot of the faith, the quote unquote faith in dieting comes from. You get this pitch. It sounds like, you know, scientifically sound. People use a bunch of big words to tell you why insulin is so important and all of this. And you have faith, and so you feel this confidence, but you're feeling the confidence more in the diet than in yourself. Then if the diet fails, your self-confidence gets a little bit wrecked, or minded. Every time a diet failed, it wasn't the diet's fault. It was my fault. I was a failure. I was broken, or more severely broken than I'd even thought. So I do think it required a little bit of that confidence in the beginning, just to start to get past the inertia of sedentariness. But nothing evaporated. You know, I always thought of like losing weight as achieving the state of enlightenment, that like I would lose the weight and it would just be like, boom, I'm normal. Oh my goodness, everything's fine. All of my insecurities are gone. All of my anxieties are gone. And it never happened. And I don't now expect it to happen. I think I have the mental garbage that I have, and it's gotten better, certainly. And I have ways of convincing myself every day almost that I'm not a total piece of garbage. You know, I can walk by and catch a glimpse of myself in a mirror and have this, oh my God, I look great moment. But for that moment, there are 20 where I see myself and I think I look terrible. I'm so fat. It's awful. I have loose skin. All of these negatives, right? I can't believe this took me this long to do, and I'm not even at such a great point. You know what I mean? Like, so it's just kind of defeating all that negativity daily is a work in progress. So I don't know that there will ever be any moment, you know, much like sobriety for me is not a state I've achieved. It's a work in progress.
I'm very curious, because this will definitely resonate with people, that attachment of the diet being a failure, but it being linked in with I'm a failure, and that self-negative talk that gets kind of clumped together as one, as opposed to, right, that diet didn't work for me, I couldn't adhere to it, I need to try something else that I can work with. But that's not what happens with people. It gets lobbed in together, and then that language of I'm a failure gets attached to it, and then every failed diet becomes a reinforcement of that. How long did it take you to remove the, assuming, because you, at the point you're at now, the way you speak, I'm assuming you're, I know it's something you manage day to day, but you seem to be out of that for sure now because of the amount of great content you have and the way you navigate the noise online. But how did you remove that failed diet, I'm a failure, language, negative self-talk, to the point that, right, this is a diet that isn't working for me. I'm not the failure. I just can't adhere to this. How long did that take, or what was that process like in terms of the removal? Or was that something that just kind of automatically happened that you weren't aware of? Or did you have to put in actual conscious work to do that removal?
No, that specifically was kind of shattered when I realized that I was doing a calorically restricted version of keto. And the whole reason I'd bought into keto, and like, I'm not anti-keto. If keto works for somebody, I say great. But for me, the reason I bought into it was not about calorie restriction. It wasn't about energy balance. It was about my body has a problem with carbohydrates. That's actually not true. Like, that is, and I'm not saying that people can have a problem with carbohydrates. Mm. That's possible. I have a kid with type 1 diabetes. Carbohydrates can send her into her blood sugar can skyrocket and it can be very unhealthy for her. So like, for her, it's a whole other set of circumstances. I don't have that. I'm not even pre-diabetic. So, and I never really was. I had a whole plethora of other medical conditions. But so I believed this thing to be true, that if I just stopped eating carbohydrates, I would find, like, that was the be-all end-all to dieting. And when I realized that it actually had nothing to do with that, I had to confront that the food was not responsible for anything, that the responsibility was entirely within me. Now, I didn't know that. I didn't really understand that fundamentally. So I'm not sitting here going like, everybody should just take personal responsibility. I think if people, that can be a loaded weapon, that can be a bad message to send to somebody that doesn't understand how, right? That doesn't understand how stuff like this works. But for me, I put my faith in diets, not in myself. And so when the diet failed, I just had so much faith that I wasn't going like, oh, it's not the right diet for me. It somehow was my fault again. Mm-hmm. And it was just a kind of confusing perspective to take. So when I realized that, like, energy balance really at the core was how any diet worked, there was nothing magical about any of these diets. If you're losing fat, it's because you are expending more energy than you're taking in. Now, however a person wants to set up a scheme to achieve that so they can maintain it, fine. If keto is the way, fine. But my understanding was I could eat as much as I want. I never had to worry about that. And as long as I didn't eat carbohydrates, I would lose weight. And that just wasn't true. Now, could there be an individual who switches from carbohydrates to fat, is more satiated, and therefore doesn't overeat? Totally. That's totally possible. But I am a binge eater. I am an overeater. I am a person who comforts themselves with food. I am a person who uses food to celebrate and also to comfort myself in times of sorrow. And if I'm doing that with fat, I'm going to gain weight.
There's so much there that I'd love to dive into, but I'm going to pick what the most obvious thing that jumped out at me. It sounds like food for you in that context, is an unsupportive coping mechanism that you've used to deal with a whole host of different emotions that come up. Did you replace the coping mechanism, or was it a case of you used another strategy or tool to, you know, when you feel that emotion of sorrow or celebration and you're not going to food now, what was your process for that? Because a lot of people don't even have awareness that their food is their unsupportive coping mechanism that they're turning to alleviate, or in your case, celebrate certain emotions that come up. What did you do there? Did you replace it with something else, or did something else, what happened?
I don't think it was like a one for one, but I will tell you this. I have found for myself that every time I walk out of a gym having exercised, I feel better. And the rest of my day is markedly better. And so I did find, you know, and it's not that I wake up every morning looking forward to it. I still often have to talk myself into going. It's this weird thing where I have like an amnesia, right? Like I walk out of the gym, and every time I walk out, I go, yes, this is why I do this. And then the next day I forget why I do it. And it's like a struggle to get in there. Not every day, and it has gotten a bit easier, but as a part of my routine, kind of trying to start my day with that physical activity, all the noise and chatter in my head is a lot quieter. And so that's been super beneficial for me. But another one, and it's also very hard to do sometimes, is if I'm suddenly very upset about something and my urge is to eat or drink or take drugs, I'll just go for a walk. And I'll go for a walk and look around, and I'm able to kind of get past that moment of succumbing to things that are unhealthy for me.
Yeah, I had Dr. Judd on the podcast for anxiety, something I struggled with for large portions of my life, and he speaks about it like waves, that emotion and that about to turn to food or whatever your unsupportive coping mechanism is will wash over like a wave if you just give it enough time. Now, that will be 90 seconds for some people, several minutes for others, maybe an hour for somebody else, but it will pass over. And I think reminding yourself of that, although hard in an emotional state, can be really useful. With physical activity, Ethan, then, because I know you were a big cycler and you lost a lot of weight when you were cycling at one point, at what stage did you bring physical activity in? Because you've been dieting for, and had been dieting for years, from a kid to teenager to early adult life, all up until your 40s, as you mentioned. What point, or at what point did physical activity come into your space then?
So I started dieting as an adult with my being a participant in these diets, like, you know, right? It was something that had been largely being done to me, and then it was something I was doing with intention in 2002. And I didn't start doing anything physical for a couple of years, you know, and this is another thing which I would encourage people to not go the route that I went. But I had this calculation in my head that I needed to lose a bunch of weight before I started doing physical exercising. And that's what I did. And I wish I hadn't done it that way. But so like 2004, 2005, I started going to a gym. And I started out with a personal trainer. I know that's not necessarily available to everyone. And I do like to offer solutions that are available to everyone. And all I would say about this, I haven't used a personal trainer in many years, and there is so much information online. You can get exercise routines, you can get videos on form, you can get everything other than a person standing over your shoulder from YouTube videos. And that's largely what I've used for the past 5 years. It's just YouTube videos. Give me 20 examples on how to build my chest and how to build my quads and what are good hamstring workouts and what's a good back workout. But I did start with a personal trainer, and I started in the gym after a couple of years of weight loss. And that was kind of the first time. You know, I didn't even have this experience in school. I just avoided physical education class in school. you know, because I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed to be like the slowest kid on the track or the last pick kid in any sports where they're picking teams. And so I would just ditch that class most of the time. So I never really had that experience in school or as a kid where really pushing yourself can lead to feeling better physically and emotionally, mentally, right? You know, I believe that any setting of a goal and having to kind of struggle to achieve it, but achieving it is like, for me, that's a state of grace.
Something that I think a lot of fitness people, and I've been training in a gym for more than 20 years, and I would be a self-identified fitness person. I love training, working out. But a lot of fitness people forget that when they started doing it first, it was really hard and it sucks. And it takes about 6 months, a year before it becomes a habit and you start to love the feeling of coming out of the gym and having done a workout. And a lot of weight loss people I've worked with in the past are always like, well, I hate to work out. And I tell them that there's this threshold point or this tipping point where, yes, it'll be a struggle every morning where you're getting in and going in and doing your workouts. But at some point, you're going to start to feel better and you're going to start to crave it. You just have to get over that tipping point. I'm going to take a little bit of a left curve. And this is something I wanted to ask as, and this is just, I'm showing my age here on top of your age, Ethan. But one of the shows, and we did a binge this during lockdown with my daughter, it was Boy Meets World.
Sure.
And when I was on your podcast, I sent it to my sister and she was like, get the fuck out of here. Because we used to watch Boy Meets World all the time and you were in that. But I'm very curious because obviously Remember the Titans was your breakout movie. Did you have, because you played the big guy in that, you were the big guy, the strong guy. Did your work as an actor have an impact on your identity being wrapped up in being a bigger guy? And was there a part of you that wanted to hold on to that? Or was weight loss something you always wanted to achieve? There was no identity tied to it. Or what did that look like when it comes to what would be considered nearly an occupational hazard in terms of identity for roles, etc.?
There's literally a few different answers I could give, but I'll say this. When I was a kid growing up in Los Angeles, there were actors at my school. And the most alluring thing that I saw with them was that other people never looked at them. They looked at a character that person played in a TV show or a movie. And it became this wonderful disguise where if I could be an actor and have people look at me, not because I'm morbidly obese, but because I'm that guy from that thing they saw, that would alleviate a bit of my feeling of shame. The other thing that was really interesting was all the characters I played were meant to be overweight, where I did not believe that I was meant to be overweight. I believed that it was a defect of mine. But if the character is supposed to be overweight, there could be this magical moment when I'm playing that character and I'm not feeling so much regret about who I am because the character's supposed to be this way. So acting was an escape for me in that way, and I felt that I could hide as an actor because I could stop being myself and I could be perceived as this other thing. I never liked being overweight. There's never been a moment where I had any confidence about my body, and you know, I found moving around in public to be really awful. Taking up more space than other people, having my stomach spill over into seats at like a concert or on a plane. You know, none of that is fun, not to mention just the amount of pressure that I felt every day having that excess weight, literal physical pressure. You know, I recently threw a 35-pound kettlebell in a backpack and went for a walk, and it was like shocking to me how hard that was. And that's only 35 pounds. Like I almost had 10 times that amount of weight.
Yeah.
So I don't know how I did anything, but I managed to do stuff. I was sweaty all the time, out of breath all the time. I was very self-conscious about my breath. Like I didn't want people to hear me breathe. So I often held my breath. It was just like not a fun existence. I always had this desire to be quote unquote normal, what I perceived to be normal. I think it can be a terrible thing to label somebody as normal because everybody's mm-hmm. got something, you know what I mean? So I hope people are aware that I'm saying that while I recognize that it's a ridiculous moniker to hang on anyone who's normal. I don't think that's a real thing. But so my perception of what normal people are, like I consider my wife to be a normal person. She can drink and it doesn't ruin her life, right? And she can eat cookies and it doesn't turn into a whole bag. She can have a cookie. That's just not me. I wanted that and I'd failed so often on so many diets. I'd kind of trampled over any kind of awareness of signals that my body sent to me about being full. I would eat so much so quickly that I even today, sometimes I have to know what an appropriate meal is prior to sitting down to eat it. But then I'll try to eat it slowly and look for cues. Like, is my body telling me this is enough food? I don't know. I just know analytically it's enough food. So I'm going to stop eating. I was never hungry. That had nothing to do with why I overate. It wasn't because I had this ravenous hunger. It was because, you know, somehow when I'd stuff myself to nearly exploding, I felt a dopamine rush or a sense of comfort or something, you know. And so that was the signal I looked for. Eat to the point where you can't eat anymore. And so having to draw the line well below that all the time now, it's not that I feel hunger and eat and feel satiated. I don't recognize any of that. I have to put like real analytical thought into this stuff. You know, I think about it like my youngest kids who are, you know, almost adults now too. They're mid to late teenage years, but they went to a French school. So they speak French, but they started doing this when they were very little. So they can fluently speak and think in French and in English. And in their head, they're not making a translation from one to the other. For me, if I learn some French words, I'm translating in my head before I say them. And if somebody says French words to me, I'm translating those into English in my head. It's the same thing with food. I am relearning what any of this stuff means. And I'm looking for the cues that my body's giving me, but it's not always that obvious.
It's not second nature just yet.
Right.
With that, because obviously there's the hunger signals, the satiation signals, and we won't get too deep into that because there's a whole rewiring there and the physiological aspect of that. But with the what I call the right automatic food choice, where you just end up making a food choice that you know is going to work for your body, do you find, you mentioned your wife there, that you know she can eat a cookie and not have the whole bag. Is that something that you have to manage day to day? So the example I've used in the past is mental health. Anxiety is something I struggle with, that I use an analogy like sweeping the floor. You could sweep the floor today, but if you don't do it tomorrow and the day after, it'll get dirty again. Do you find that food and binge eating on certain foods is the same for you? Or are you kind of cross the chasm at this point where you're just making the right automatic food choice, or is it a combination of both? Or are you very militantly, I'm aware this is an issue, I need to stay on top of it day to day?
I can find myself sitting, you know, if we do a big dinner at our house and there's all this food and lots of people and it's family style. So there's a big platter of meat and a big platter of potatoes and a big platter of this and that. I sometimes will have to move stuff out of arm's reach just so that it's not, I'm not mindlessly taking more, because I will sometimes mindlessly take more. Now, if I go to a restaurant, I might automatically think I'm going to get a poached fish or something not fried, or, you know, I'll go for grilled instead. I'll ask for a couple of eggs and to add, like, you know, four extra egg whites. And, you know, I'm trying to lean towards leaner cuts of meat and whole grains and one word ingredients, right? I don't want to eat a bag of Doritos, but a bag of celery, I can eat that mindlessly. It's not going to mess me up, or carrots or something like that, or have an apple, right? So I have found that those things have become much easier. But there still is that translation. And I like your, I like what you said. There's the floor doesn't stay clean forever. You got to do work. So like where I had always thought, like there will be this state I achieve, that's never happened. So while I think the more you sweep the floor, the better at sweeping the floor you get, you know, you still have to sweep it if you want a clean floor.
That's great advice. And I'm going to follow it up with that. What I know is a loaded question on the front end, because there's a million different answers and it's not a do this to get that. But with keeping weight off, this is something that I get asked so frequently with people I work with. And as somebody that is in that position now, is an authority in that position, talks to people on the podcast and helps others navigate the noise. And anyone that's not subscribed to the American Glutton podcast, I highly recommend you do so. I'll link it in the description for today's podcast. But a loaded question is, what's the hardest part of keeping the weight off? And as I said, I know it's not a single answer because there's a million different things that compound on top of one another. But when people ask you a similar question, Ethan, what do you normally offer as an answer when it comes to the hardest part of keeping weight off?
Yeah, I do have, you know, and again, like you said, I think this could be answered differently on any given day. Like depending on the day I'm having, I could answer it differently. But the thing I've been thinking about most as the hardest aspect is being okay with not being as lean as my mind tells me I should be at all times. And you know, I can get down to single digit body fat. I've done it.
You have done in your photo shoots, yeah.
It's so hard and so miserable and so much work that it's just like good for a day. It's good for one day. And even then, I don't know how worth it is for me to repeat that often. So then I go like, okay, well, if I'm 16% body fat today, and that requires effort, but the effort doesn't put me into a bad mood, and it's not, you know, it just requires the sweeping every day, right? Which I'm getting better at. So the sweeping becomes easier and easier. So that's the amount of effort. But I'm still in my head going, you're fat, dude. 16% body fat. What's wrong with you? Get to 12. Stay at 12. I think for me, it's that battle with myself of any, you know, well, why can't you get down to 12 and maintain 12? And it's like, it's so much more work. It's like sweeping and dusting and doing the windows and vacuuming the couch every, you know what I mean? It's like being the dust monitor and like, and so it's the difference between like white glove cleaning a house so you could go around every surface with a white glove and check it for dust, or sweeping. And it's like, what kind of life do I want to have? Do I want to have this life where, you know, and you know, I think it's also kind of hard with pop culture, where I love Chris Hemsworth and I think Thor is awesome. And I want Thor to have that nude scene where he's peeled and gigantic and looks like a god. Thor's a god. He better look like that. But I know for sure he only looked like that for one day, and maybe even just for a couple of hours that day. So I know that simply because I've done a version of that. I never looked that good, but I've done a version of that. So I know what kind of work that takes. I think that we're inundated with images that kind of have me going like, oh, in order to feel normal, which again, I didn't feel normal that day. I felt miserable the day I got there, but like I have to look like X, right? So for me, that's the hardest thing, is to kind of talk myself into finding some state that is a little bit in conflict with what my desire is. Does that make sense?
100%. Well, something I've recommended to people is finding your sweet spot, that point where you're happy with how you look, but you can go out for a meal with your family or your partner, or you can go for a few drinks, assuming, you know, that's your thing that you want to go for, and you've got this balance of you feel good, your energy is good, sex drive good, sleep is good, all those things that get negatively affected when your body fat becomes too low. It's so weird, because I was a competitive bodybuilder, but all the stuff that happens on the obese end of the spectrum happens on the low level of body fat of the spectrum as well, which is mental when you think about it.
Yeah.
But I'm very curious, and I know this is very specific to you, Ethan, but just to help people with a timeline, how long did it take you to find where your sweet spot was? And the reason I ask that question is because you can get down to that fitness model photo shoot conditioning, and you've done it, you could do it again. And just as easily, if you said, press the fuck it button and said, you know what, I don't care anymore.
No more sweeping.
Yeah, no more sweeping. I'm done. You throw it out, you break it, you throw it out the door. Like, you could go back to 500 pounds, but you have the sweet spot in between. What was your timeline in terms of how long it took to get there? I assume it wasn't in the weeks. It was probably in the months, maybe even in the years. But what was your kind of timeline for, this is my sweet spot, I'm good here, and I can maintain this?
It was in the years. It was kind of years of doing maintenance. And you know, it's a little bit like you do a calculation and you go, how many calories should I be eating? And then you eat those calories and you go like, oh my God, I'm gaining weight. And so there's two factors to that. When you have lost a lot of weight, your calories are probably going to be less anyway than what they would for a person who hasn't lost a lot of weight and weighs the same as you. So that's one of the factors. But the other factor is, I don't want to be hungry, right? I don't want to be hungry. So hunger is real. And when you get down, what my experience was, when I got down really lean, I was really hungry. Like, I felt hunger, which I think it's okay to be a little bit hungry. But when you're always hungry, when you've eaten your meal and your body is saying, I'm still hungry, that's not a good feeling. So I think it's got a little bit to do with that. And I like what you said about being able to go out to a meal with your family. Like, I have a wife and four kids and a granddaughter, and like, none of them are on a diet, right? So like, am I just going to be a non-participant in the majority of their life, or this part of the majority of their life? I want to be able to, you know, and not show them like, oh, I'm going out on a meal to have a meal with you tonight. I'm going to eat so much. I'm going to eat myself sick, right? Like, not that, but like, set the example of being in control of this for them, you know, of having a meal and not overeating and not undereating and not having eaten before we go to the restaurant and sitting there and pretending like I'm perfectly fine watching them eat. You know, I've done all of that and none of that feels good. So I think it's a lot of those factors. One of the points I want to say to what you said, feeling good about how you look, this for me is a real struggle. And the thing that I've got to confront, or I've had to confront at some point, is I may never feel good about how I look for all the time, right? It might not be something that is permanent. It might be something that I have to analytically talk myself into and go like, I have visible abs today. I'm not overly fat, right? I can see my abs. Does it take good lighting to really reveal them? Yeah, but it also did when I was 10% body fat. We used good lighting. So like, could I be leaner than I am? Yeah, but I'd be miserable. So I'm sacrificing my happiness at that point. And I've got to just get good with how I look, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And I've only got a couple of other questions, but one that is going to be, I'm unaware, and I apologize in advance, it's going to be impossible to answer because I'm going to ask for future self and forward projection on this. But just based on what you said there, Ethan, about, you know, you might never be 100% comfortable with how you look. Is that something that you are currently working on? Or is it something that you've made peace with, that this just might be the way this is, and I'll have days when I feel okay with how I look and days I don't feel okay with how I look? Or what is your forward projection in what you intend to and how you potentially want to work with that? Because I know there's a lot of people who are in a similar boat, and that will instantly, as soon as you said it, it might be a aha moment that, oh, I actually might never feel 100% with how I look. How is that going to look for you? Or what's your idea for that at the moment?
Yeah, I would say I started doing this when I was about 330 pounds, just because I'd lost 200 pounds at that point. And that's a big accomplishment, right? Now my health had improved and I was active. I was going to the gym every day. And I started doing this because I would get so down on myself at that point when I'd accomplished so much. And I go, this isn't fair. It's not fair to, you know, be in your head so negative about yourself when you're on a good path and you've accomplished so much. Like, knock it off, dude. Like, shut the fuck up. And the way I would do it would be like, I would stand in the mirror. You know, it almost always would happen like after I'd brush my teeth in the morning. You know, I'd have no shirt on. I'd brush my teeth and I'd kind of stand up from having done that and be confronted with what I looked like. And I'd almost always feel bad. And so I had to go, okay, that's it. Is there any part of your body that you can find right now that isn't just garbage? And it almost always would be my traps. I'd look at my traps and I'd go, ah, I see some muscle definition there. That's pretty cool. And then I could kind of build on that. And I still do that. I don't necessarily do it every day now, but you know, I think it's similar to sweeping. Like if we're just garbage, why should we try to do anything? If we've got a voice in our head saying, try to achieve this goal, then you got to also be willing to acknowledge when you do achieve stuff and to own that. And I'm not advocating for a bunch of cocky people, because I think, you know, pride can be also repulsive, but there's got to be some balance there where, like, if you achieve something, give yourself a pat on the back. Doesn't mean stop, right? Or it doesn't mean like go back to what you were doing. I think that's the other problem. It's like a razor's edge. One side for me is I've accomplished so much, I can stop working. The other side is I've accomplished so little, why try to work? So both sides lead to failure and regression, right? So there's a fine line where it's like, I can acknowledge what I've accomplished, I can pat myself on the back, and I can get back to work.
I love that. And just to point out for people, like, negativity bias is a real thing. Like, it's an evolutionary thing that kept people alive thousands of years ago in the African savannah, but now it manifests in not being happy with the image that you see. And I love what you said there in terms of a call to action for people that's very practical. Focus on the area of your body or that you are happy when you look in the mirror. If as you said, 95% of you are like, I'm not happy, but there's 5% of you are like, I'm, you know, my ass looks great today, or you know, I like the way my shoulders look or my traps look. Like, that's just rewiring your mindset towards that positive thinking, which I think over a long period of time can really compound positively.
Ethan, wait, let me say one more thing, Brian. If you can do a compare and contrast too, because a lot of these changes are happening so gradually that we're not even like watching them change. We just are looking at ourselves as though this is what it's always been. But for me, you know, there was so much that had changed and had changed over years that it was like, oh yeah, remember when getting out of bed hurt? That didn't happen today. That's good. If I still look like shit, but I'm in less pain, that's a benefit. You know what I mean? Like, it's a lot of that.
Well, the bar moves. That's partly the problem with weight loss and most achievements. Like, the bar moves. You hit a goal, you hit a target, you lose 100 pounds, you want to lose 120. You lose 120, you want to lose 150. And the bar just keeps moving with it. And I think focusing on those small wins, like you said, like, you might not be happy with how you look, but you're in less pain. That's massive. Like, I think that's a huge takeaway. And for anyone that's listening to this podcast that isn't subscribed to American Glutton, you do episodes on there where you're bringing on expert guests, you're bringing on. I love the episode recently with, is it Nancy Cartwright from The Simpsons? I love that episode.
She's awesome.
I really enjoyed that. Yeah, it was really good. And talking about her weight loss story on there as well. And there's so much value. You answer questions at the end of some of them and you've got your own solo episodes. Cannot recommend it enough as a show for people to check out. But Ethan, I've loved this conversation. I think you're doing incredible work as somebody that is a fan of your work when it comes to your artistic work with acting, but also of the podcast. You've got a twofold fan from me on this side. So I've loved this conversation. For anybody that's listening, where is the best place for them to find out from you? Obviously, Instagram, you post quite regularly on there, the American Glutton Podcast. Is there anywhere else you'd like to send people? And I will link it in the description.
Yeah, really just Instagram. I'm on Twitter too, but I'm inactive because it's not fun. People are mean on Twitter and people are nice on Instagram.
Well, there you go. For everybody, head over and be nice on Instagram. And that's a nice little call to action on top of everything else we talked about today. Be nicer on social media. I think that's, I think I could put that at the end of every podcast and it would stand true. And I will link the podcast, American Glutton, in the show notes and the description on BrianKeenFitness.com and wherever you're listening to your podcast and the Instagram page. Go check it out. Some great stuff on there. And at the minute, if you're listening to this podcast as we're recording it in September 2022, you can see the photo shoot on there as well and some of your ridiculous transformation from that 500 pound plus to 200 pound plus is just absolutely incredible. So Ethan, keep inspiring, keep doing what you're doing, and thank you so much for your time.
Brian, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Episode 400 in the bag, Hollywood actor Ethan Suplee on losing over 290 pounds, weight loss mistakes to avoid, and the major lessons he learned along the way. With all 400 episodes, this is right up there one of my favorite conversations as somebody that is such a huge fan of Ethan's work on and off screen. And hopefully you enjoyed the podcast as much as I enjoyed recording it. If you did, be sure to take a screenshot of it, pop it up on your Instagram stories. You can tag both of us, Brian_Keen_fitness, and you can tag Ethan Suplee, S-U-P-L-E-E, all one word, on Instagram as well. Thanks so much for listening. I'll catch you all next week.